Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to Conspiracy Theory Thursday, the day of the week when we hear most of the conspiracy theories that I think are likely to crop up during the week. By the way, tomorrow we'll be broadcasting live from one of my favorite places and a great place to go Christmas shopping, Northwest Armory, one of my favorite gun stores, and I'd be glad to have you stop by in person if you get the chance. You know, we're planning First Amendment Friday remotes all over the Pacific Northwest in the 12 months ahead, and we're glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network, spanning Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and serving the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio. If you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. But the first thing I wanted to mention to you is our Twitter poll today. You'll find the Twitter poll a couple of different places. One is on Twitter, @LarsLarsonShow. The other is on our website, Lars Larson Show. Here's our question. Should every high school graduate get free community college, including illegal aliens and those with bad GPAs? Now, if you think, Lars, that sounds like a crazy idea, you've slanted the question in such a way that nobody is going to answer yes to that. Well, there's already at least one yes answer to that, and that is the new mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkin, who says she wants the city to fund, at a cost of tens of millions of dollars, free community college for every single high school graduate, whether the high school graduate is legally in the United States or not, whether the high school graduate has a good GPA, that is grade point average, or a bad GPA, doesn't matter what. Doesn't matter how well prepared they are for any kind of college, she wants to fund it at the cost of about $4,000 per year per student to go to community college. Now, somehow she must believe that the city of Seattle, like any city in this region, has so much extra cash that they can go out and take on a brand new responsibility, create a brand new entitlement, because remember, this is exactly what an entitlement is. When the government says we're going to make a promise to give something of value away at no cost whatsoever to the person getting the thing of value, but to great cost to the taxpayers of the city, that's exactly what we're talking about. Now, she's already signed an executive order that says this is going to happen. This isn't going to be put to a vote unless somebody goes out and scares up an initiative petition to submit it to a vote of the public. They're going to simply give it away. Now, I'll tell you something. My personal perspective on this is that almost everybody coming out of high school could use some extra training. It might be exactly the kind of training they need. Not a four-year degree, not going to a four-year college, but some training so that you can go into some of the various trades out there that are crying for new workers. Welders, people working with metal, people working with tile, people working in construction. I'm not arguing that people couldn't use this, but I'll tell you that having talked to a number of community college instructors, a number of you have even called the show, those instructors that are paying attention tell you that they can spot the students in their classes who are paying for their own classes and differentiate them from the students in their classes who are having somebody else pay the tab for their education, whether it's the government, whether it's a loan, whether it's mom and dad, whether it's grandma and grandpa. They can always spot those students. And why? Because the students who are paying for their own education take it very, very seriously. The ones who get it so-called free, meaning at somebody else's expense, they tend to take that education very, very casually. It doesn't mean as much to them, and therefore they don't invest as much of their time and attention in taking full advantage of that. Now, that's what Jenny Durkin wants to do. The new mayor of Seattle wants to take your tax dollars, and she wants to spend it to provide education to students who may or may not even care about the education. They may, in fact, waste the opportunity because they have nothing invested in it. In fact, I would suggest that if you came out of high school with a bad GPA, you're not likely to invest much because you may not be even ready to take advantage of the kind of education that you could get at a local community college. So I think this is a terrible idea. I wish somebody would put it to a vote. I have a feeling that even the liberal voters of the city of Seattle would vote this down. I have a feeling that the liberal voters of a city like Portland or Eugene would vote it down as well. You want to jump into the conversation? We'll get to that in just a moment at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Well, President Donald Trump has been tweeting. There's nothing new about that. And he's been tweeting and retweeting a woman in Great Britain by the name of Jada Franzen. The president's critics are practically apoplectic about this. Theresa May, the British prime minister, has even condemned the president for the retweets of Jada Franzen. And why? Because they say this woman is a far right criminal. Let me tell you why. Far right because she opposes the kind of Islamic terrorist attacks, half a dozen in Great Britain in just the past year, that have killed dozens of people. That's actually my kind of far right. And Jada Franzen is a criminal, too. That's right. She's been convicted of free speech in Great Britain. She's literally been put in jail for things that she has said from a podium and from behind a radio microphone. I know, that sounds crazy. Here in America, you can't be put in jail just for saying things unless those things pose an immediate threat. But remember that our British cousins do not have a First Amendment. And in that country, free speech can be criminal. And now Donald Trump is being condemned for helping a speech criminal? He should wear that charge as a badge of honor.
Insane.
Are you
ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Arm Yourself Gun Store in Hillsboro. Proudly veteran owned and open 7 days a week. ArmYourselfStore.com.
I want to tell you as a parenthetical comment on this Daily Grill that we have invited Republican State Senator Jeff Cruz to come on this program and to address some of the sexual charges that have been made against him. I know, in the great scheme of things with Matt Lauer's and Harvey Weinstein's and, you know, Kevin Spacey's, that Jeff Cruz as a state senator kind of ranks toward the bottom of that list, but we have invited him to come on. I'd love to hear what he has to say. But here's who I'm going to give the Daily Grill to. The legislative officials who say that they want Jeff Cruz investigated, and presumably they want him pushed out of the legislature, probably more because he's a Republican than because of what he might have done or not done, because now they say they haven't been able to figure out who they should have come in and investigate the accusations of sexual harassment. Well, I've got an easy solution for these dim bulbs at the state legislature. You call up a law enforcement agency, pick any of the sheriff's departments outside of Marion County, and you say to them, we'd like to borrow one of your detectives, presumably a high-ranking detective with a lot of years of experience and no ties to the state legislature or anybody serving in it. We'd like to borrow that lieutenant or captain detective, send them to Salem, have them sit down and do a thorough investigation of Jeff Cruz. If he has committed crimes, then refer those for prosecution. If it is merely some bad behavior that he's engaged in, but it's beyond the pale, then recommend him for removal from the Oregon Senate. But they can't figure out who to have investigate this? That's pretty darn pathetic. Today's best email, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you today by Papa Shoehorns, the perfect Christmas gift for everybody on your list. On the web at PapaShoehorns.com. Merle writes in, Lars, here's a copy of my letter to the House Speaker. Mr. Speaker, the House's ratings at 13.2% simply do not have much room for any more negative revelations, but they keep on coming. And now we're informed there is a sex slush fund. It is your duty to do the following. When was the fund formed? By whom? Who authorized the financing? How was the fund reauthorized? And for how much? Who approved each one of these requests? It'd be a good idea for you to ask and obtain all of the funds to be returned, and you should inform the public when that task has been accomplished. Signed, Merle in Florence. Glad to get your emails and your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Tomorrow, we'll be live for First Amendment Friday from Northwest Armory. Stop by if you're in the neighborhood. And I mentioned the Free Community College executive order that was signed by Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan. The very first thing that she did in office, and I'm curious what you think of the idea. Ashley is on the line. Hey, Ashley, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay. I think it's absolutely crazy. I think it's crazy because, I mean, already we're giving these kids, you know, the extra years on the parents' insurance, health insurance.
Yeah.
The increase in minimum wage. Where is the motivation? So basically, you're just going to have these people sitting in classrooms taking up time. I mean, if they didn't do well in high school, why do we think they're going to do well in college?
No reason.
I don't get it.
No
and the amount of money that would be thrown at this, it just makes no sense. I mean, we need to have more competition. There needs to be, you know, an initiative. You know, these kids need a reason to achieve.
Well, think about the ways you usually incentivize kids to have initiative. If you say, would you like to play football? Sure, I'd like to play. What do I have to do? Well, you have to try out. Oh, you mean if I try out, I may or may not make the team. Yeah, you might not make the team. You might end up being JV or you might make your way to varsity. It just depends on how hard you work. What would happen if you said, we're gonna play a game and you don't have to pay anything to play and there's no competition to it at all? Then how do you indicate or how do you get the greatest effort out of somebody? If somebody makes a sports team, whether it's the golf team or the tennis team or the swimming team, I have a dog in the fight there because I was on the swim team in junior high. You can get off the swim team as well. If you don't show up for practice, if you don't hit your marks, if you don't put in effort, the coach can say, we don't need you here. Get out of here. But this is going to be something that'll, as you say, allow somebody to while away another couple of years before they get serious about life, because they can always say, well, I'm in school, you know, because Jenny Durkan said that the other taxpayers who work hard for their paychecks are going to pay for my school for at least 2 years.
Not only that, but teachers are evaluated on the success of their students.
Yep.
And so how is that going to skew things? You know, are we just going to keep pushing people through that aren't putting in the effort and aren't learning the material and just keep pushing them through? And why should another student who is actively engaged in their education, wanting to learn, why should they put in the effort if the other people aren't?
I couldn't agree with you more. And by the way, you know that there's a scandal that's breaking or broke this week in Washington, D.C. And what it had to do with was a school where the teachers were earning their bonuses based on how well the kids did. So they handed out, they made sure that everyone graduated from the school. And before you say, well, that's great, everybody graduated, how did they do that? They had students who had missed more than 90 days of school, almost half a year, and yet somehow they managed to pass the classes that they were in. And what I think really happened was the administrators and some of the teachers said, we need to make our bonuses. We need to make sure that every one of these kids gets marked as a pass and then passed on through the system, just like you said.
Exactly.
Anyway, Ashley, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Robin in Corvallis. Hey, Robin, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here, Lars. The logic of some of this doesn't make any sense. Now, here's what I'm going to say as a retired professor who used to teach. Okay, I would say yes if this is a 10th or 11th grade high school student who is doing very well and wants to move forward in it, you know, quickly.
Okay.
A lot of our high school classes, I know with my two sons, they were bored to death by the time they were in 12th grade. I would say no unless a student has something like 3.7 GPA in high school when they graduate. And they can also produce a document that basically states what they want to do, like computer science or whatever it happens to be.
Something that leads to a job or a profession, right?
Yes. Yeah. And so there's actually examples that I'm aware of here in the state where you can go from your high school to a community college, and that's assuming your parents are going to back it,
yep,
and your parents are going to make sure you can get to the school.
Although most of the kids who graduate high school are 18 years of age, should we still be holding parents responsible to get you to school when you're an adult?
No. For the one that has a high school diploma, they would have to have an exceptional, GPA that would provide them with being able to stay locally, and we could keep them and get them into the system.
By the way, Professor, because I know we're going to run up against the clock, I want to tell you, I want to get your comment on this, because I can imagine how much you're going to love this proposal. I'll read to you straight out of the Seattle Times Fish Wrapper describing Mayor Jenny Durkin's idea. It's not an idea. She signed an executive order, so apparently it's going to happen. Tuition is $4,000 a year. She figures that expanding the program will cost as much as $7 million a year, and maybe more than that. And that's with only a quarter of the graduates taking part. And it says, as with the existing scholarship, Durkin's program will have no income restriction, no GPA restriction, and will be open to undocumented students, meaning illegal aliens, and graduates will be eligible for the program for 2 years after leaving high school. So you don't have to make a GPA. You don't have to be legally here in the country. You don't have anything. And even if your parents are rich, you'll still be able to get the free tuition at the expense of the taxpayers. What do you think of that program?
This is a bogus politician who just wants to get reelected, because I, as a professor, would get students in my classes that didn't even belong in school. And I know plenty of other university professors who have said it's a growing problem that anywhere between 25% or 33% of their classes have students that really don't even belong in college. And that's a fact.
And by the way, when you say don't belong, I want people to understand, I'm interpreting this as they don't have the intellectual wherewithal. They haven't done the preparatory work to be able to take advantage of the class in front of them. If they don't know the math or they don't know the other background, they shouldn't be in that classroom until they're ready to actually make use of the education provided for them. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. It is Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And I started off with a little commentary about the president's retweets. I just can't believe what a big deal this seems to have become. There is a woman in Great Britain who is viewed by that country as a criminal. She is a criminal only because of free speech. In other words, the things that she was actually put in jail for in Great Britain were no more outrageous than the free speech of Black Lives Matter here in America, Antifa here in America, Occupy Wall Street here in America, the World Trade Organization protests in Seattle a few years ago. Any of the outrageous speech, and I think some of it was outrageous generically, but was it something that you should get thrown in prison for or thrown in jail for? No. But you have to remember that in Great Britain, there is no free speech. There's no First Amendment that guarantees that you have the right to free speech. So as a result, they have literally thrown this woman in jail a couple of different times for merely giving speeches where she didn't threaten anybody. She said things that were outrageous to some people. Of course, I say things that are outrageous to some people. So just a moment ago, Sarah Huckabee Sanders at the White House was engaging in the daily press briefing with all the liberal lunatics from CNN and NBC. Like, NBC doesn't have other problems to deal with right now. And a number of reporters began asking her about the president's retweets. Some of the thinking behind this, or lack of thinking, by some of these reporters would absolutely stun you. Take a listen.
So, Sarah, I want to ask about the video the president tweeted yesterday. Firstly, does the president feel that he has an obligation to ensure that the information that he shares on his Twitter feed to millions of people is accurate?
Now, she's asking, does the president know that he has an obligation to make sure that the information shared on his Twitter feed is accurate? Now, I don't know where this reporter thinks that the president has an obligation. I think generically he should probably try to make sure that things on his Twitter feed are accurate. But then again, most of the mainstream media should make sure that the things that they're reporting are accurate. And many times they are not. And you do not get abject apologies from them for that. But here's the rest of the question.
I think the president feels that bringing up important issues of our time, like extreme violence and terrorism, are important to do. That was what he was doing in that process. And I think he's going to continue to do that in a number of venues, whether it's through speeches, whether it's through Twitter or other social media platforms.
Does he understand, Sean? Though, that sharing those videos might incite violence against Muslims? And does he understand that he's...
Does he understand that sharing those videos might incite violence against Muslims? Now, let me tell you my perspective on this. Over the last, go back to 9/11 or even a little bit before 9/11. Go all the way back to the first bombing of the World Trade Center towers. Do you think that we have seen things over the last 20, 25 years that would just scare the daylights out of almost anybody? We have seen people in cages burned to death. We have seen people who have had their heads cut off on video, and that video either broadcast or made available on the web. We have seen people who were told to either convert to Islam or die, and we have seen them murdered by Islamic criminals. We have seen people murdered in some of the big capitals of the world, including Paris, including London. London itself has had six major terrorist attacks in the last 11 months since the beginning of this year that have killed literally dozens and dozens of people, all of them linked to Islamic terrorism. And some of them with images that are absolutely horrific. And this woman, this reporter, is asking the president's spokeswoman, does the president know that when he retweets a video, some of the videos show a man being thrown off the top of a building? Well, you know, over the last 25 years, I have seen videos of people being thrown off the top of buildings. And do you know who's doing most of the throwing off the top of buildings? Islamic terrorists. And do you know who they're doing it to? They're doing it to gays. They're doing it to people who are judged to be apostates because they no longer want to be part of Islam and they've converted to Christianity. But you're not allowed to do that because in the Muslim world, the sentence, the penalty for rejecting Islam and becoming an apostate is death. We saw literally a few years ago a young woman who was pregnant, who was married to a Christian man and had converted to Christianity, and she was thrown in prison in a Muslim country. She was finally freed eventually, but she was imprisoned for quite a time. Why? Her crime was rejecting Islam. Now, this woman says, doesn't the president know that if you show some of these images of Muslims doing terrible things to people, that it might incite violence against Muslims? Well, it might. But do you know, since 9/11, the number of times that we've actually seen anybody who's Muslim attacked, who's not doing something already that's illegal, you could count on the fingers of one hand. For the most part, Americans and Britons have treated people of other faiths fairly and equitably, and they do not go out and simply engage in random violence against people because they're followers of Islam. And if Americans react adversely to people who are Muslim who go out and carry out acts of terrorism, like driving a car down a street of a major American university, Ohio State, and running people down with an SUV, you know, crimes like that, yes, Americans are outraged by that, but do they go out and take it out on their Muslim friends and neighbors and coworkers? No, they don't. Yet here's a reporter saying the president shouldn't share images like that because it might bring, untoward violence against followers of Islam. This is the kind of lunacy that people in the press right now are practicing. To your calls now, let's go to Diana, who's calling in. Hey, Diana, welcome to the program. I take it you heard me talking about Mayor Jenny Durkin's idea for free community college, no matter whether you're legally here or not, no matter what your grades are. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I am totally outraged.
You know what, Diana? I can't hear what you're saying. We'll see if we can get you to a cleaner line, and we'll talk to you then. Let's go to Jim in Mount Vernon. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Thank you. I disagree with what Durkin is doing in general. But one issue I have, I heard you talking about the grade point average.
Yeah.
And I have to take issue with that. I graduated from high school second in my class, not from the top, but from the bottom.
Yeah.
And I had a 1.3 grade average. After 2 years out of high school, I realized I needed college. I tried to apply at Skagit Valley College and was turned down, but the next quarter or the next year, they were low on enrollment. So I went back and they said, yeah, we give everybody a chance.
Yeah.
Well, after the initial quarter, I was on the second quarter I was in college. I got on the honor roll. I did 2 years of college there on the honor roll. Then I went on to four-year college, which I never thought I would ever do.
Yeah.
And I was on the honor roll there for the 2 years I was there, too. The difference was, I guess, I realized education was important, and I didn't realize that during high school.
And this was several years later, right?
It was 2 years out of high school that I realized I better learn how to read and write.
Yeah, and when did you finally go back to the community college after you learned to read and write? How many years after?
I went back to the community college 2 years after high school.
Okay. So this program only applies for the 2 years immediately following high school. So her program is to allow students who've done very poorly in high school to go out and have their community college paid for when presumably they may not have the same kind of experience that you had where you figured out, I better get things straightened out or I'm not going to be able to make a living, right?
Correct. But I, the first time I tried to get into college was 1 year out of high school.
Yeah, and they told you no.
I finally made it. And then they needed enrollment, so the cash talked. So I went back after the second year, and ultimately they told me through testing I would have about a 2% chance of making an engineering career, and wanted to push me into the social services stuff, and I had no interest in that.
Congratulations on your success, and I appreciate the phone call, Jim. Back in just a moment, you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Tomorrow, live from Northwest Armory for First Amendment Friday, and glad to take your calls today at 866-HEY-LARS. Let's go to Everett, who's calling in from the South Coast. Hey, Everett, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, we were discussing the, you were discussing the college situation that was proposed. I'd like to step back one step on that and back into high school. And at the age of 16, people become mobile in our society.
Yeah.
They should have
or they
the
can
ability.
Be.
Pardon?
They can be if they want to.
They can be.
A lot of them are passing on the driver's license, which I think is a tremendous deficit for them as a potential employee.
Well, what my point is that the majority are. Okay, if you have three different directions to go at high school, the number one is that you can get out and go to work wherever you're going to go to work. Two is that you go straight college prep. And three is that you go vocational.
Yeah.
Now, see, to me, it seems ludicrous to take and spend 12 years of school and come out qualified for nothing.
I'd agree with you, although I think it's possible to go through the public schools and come out qualified for a number of jobs if you choose to. But it all depends on what you choose to access out of that K through 12 education. I mean, you can coast through and do the minimum. I knew kids in high school, and I wasn't as accomplished academically as they were, but I admired them. They took every calculus course, every chemistry course, every science course. They took every writing course they could. And then there were the kids who said, I want a perfect GPA because it'll make mom and dad happy. And I don't know, maybe there's even a bonus attached to it. You know, if mom says, hey, if you get a 4 point, I'll give you $100 at the end of the year. So they took all the pass, no pass classes where all you had to do was pass them. Or they took the easy grab classes that were easy to score a great grade in, an A. An A was easy. The calculus classes were the tougher ones. So you can access a lot out of school if you choose to, or you can slide through and do the minimum.
Well, I agree with you on that. But there's so many people out there that you don't need. You need welders. You need all the different functions of the normal community.
Well, then how about if Jenny Durkin is going to provide free college, meaning paid for by somebody else, that if she, and I know that as a liberal, she's not likely to do this, but my proposal would be to say to the community colleges, you can have free college if it is in classes that actually lead to a job. If it's pre-nursing, if it's welding, if it's plumbing, if it's HVAC, if it's, you know, something that actually leads to a job that pays well, then we will pay for your tuition. But if you want to go down there and just take, you know, easy classes in this and easy classes in that, you know, so that you can while away two more years and use it as an excuse to not get serious about life, I don't see why the taxpayers should be paying for that.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you totally. However, if you would simply step back into high school and get that all done in high school, it's already being paid for.
Yep.
And the people that get out at 16, that they do nothing but cause trouble for the last 2 years anyway.
Well, that's Everett. I'll make one correction to that. I had some acquaintances who got out of high school at 16 because it bored them to tears. They went right to college, knocked off 2 years of community college, then went into a four-year college, and some of them had advanced degrees by the time they were in their early 20s, which is something to be admired. If that's the course you're taking, or if you say, I want to get out of high school at 16 and I want to go to community college and say, take that welding class so that at age 18, I can be out making $40,000 a year as a welder with an upside potential of $70,000 or $80,000 or $100,000 a year, I'd go for that plan too, as long as you got some kind of plan.
I agree.
Well, I appreciate the phone call. Thanks very much. Let's go to Paul in Lakewood. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a school board member in Culver Park.
Yep.
And, you know, we're working very hard in the state of Washington. As you know, our constitution is pretty clear. We have to provide a basic education. And I think that's where the big fight is. And we have kids that are dropping out. So whoever was on just before, they talked a little bit about three different options.
Yeah.
And I think what we have to do is we have to look at each child as different. Instead of having a assembly line process where everybody's treated the same, we need to get them to be what's successful. So we're working on a project right now with our community to say, what is success? How do we define success for each child? Once we do that, then we can say, okay, the basic education that each child needs is this. We can put line items against that and say, hey, what's the cost? Instead of going to the legislature and keep saying we need more money, we can say, hey, this is what it's going to cost us to do these things. If you agree with us, help fund it. If not, we may even be able to save some money as we go forward.
You know, I think that's a great idea. And could we define, if a basic education is enough to be self-sufficient, right, capable of earning a living and providing for yourself, would that be a good starting definition?
Well, I think the community has to define that. But, Lars, I like what you're saying. I think that's what most of us think, that they should be able to self-sustaining in whatever they do. But, you know, the bottom line from my perspective is if we help a child learn their passion, teach them some basics like reading and maybe a little bit of numbers, you know, we can get out of the roads. Kids will be successful. And I always use that Bill Gates as that one. You know, he never got a college degree. He got to learn the things he wanted to learn because his parents had access to things that not all our children do. So how do we give access to each child so that they can get to where they need to be?
Well, and how about an incentive for them to actually get out and get what they have access to? Because some of them just turn it down. Paul, hold on the line for just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment on all the issues of the day right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. With all the other crazy things going on in the world, I think we've let our attention on the Supreme Court drift a little bit, but the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing some very serious arguments on some big cases that have the real potential to affect us in our daily lives. And I thought I'd invite on Carrie Severino, who is Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Judicial Crisis Network. Carrie, it's good to have you back on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
It's great to be here.
So tell me about this case in Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. This is the kind of thing that we've seen play out in a number of states around America, isn't it?
Exactly. There's another case that the court is holding to decide maybe right after this one, Arlene Flowers, which is the Washington florist. We've seen photographers. We've seen a lot of different types of wedding vendors involved. In this case, the Colorado Civil Rights Commission said that there was no ability for a cake decorator who really considers himself an artist. He does beautiful artistic cakes. Cannot refuse to make a cake for a same-sex wedding on religious grounds, even though they were willing to say that someone could refuse to make a cake that gave a lot of other messages. So you could refuse to make a cake that was a white supremacist message or a cake that was an anti-same-sex marriage message. But they said you're not allowed to do it in this case when this is a Christian man who has a lot of other ways he lives out his faith in his business. He doesn't make bachelorette party cakes that might have sketchy messages. He doesn't do a scary Halloween cakes. He just wants to be able to live his faith out through his business. And the Supreme Court's now going to decide whether he will continue to have the First Amendment right to do that. It's going to be an interesting case and very likely a very close decision.
And by the way, this is Jack Phillips out of Denver, Colorado, who's even declined to make cakes that celebrate divorce. So he's holding to his religious beliefs in his interaction with, you know, the rest of the world. Does this come down to a matter of a free speech question, a First Amendment free speech question, or a First Amendment religious practice question, or does it come down to a little bit of both?
It really has both, and we'll see. The court may decide it on some combination of, or just decide it one of those issues. But this has been a court that has been very protective of First Amendment claims in general, particularly free speech claims, but also freedom of religion claims. And I think the court recognizes that this is something that protects us all, including people we disagree with. So there's a lot of cases where, you know, the justices in the court probably didn't agree with the message that was being given in the case. For example, people who were making snuff videos of killing animals, or people who were protesting at military funerals. Just because they're willing to stand up for the First Amendment rights of the people doesn't mean they agree with them. And I hope that's the principle that will apply in this case as well, because we know the Supreme Court is very closely divided on whether the same-sex marriage decision mandating that nationwide was correct. But then the question remains, there's still room left for religious freedom here, or does that trump even our First Amendment rights that are in the Constitution itself? I'm optimistic that the court will say, no, there has to be a live and let live here. And that's something that there's definitely a lot of room for. The people in this case, the couple was able to get another cake from another bakery. There's a lot of bakeries who are looking for that business. And so I think if a few people want to say, you know, this, I can't do this cake, but, you know, the person down the street certainly can, that we need to find a way that can protect their religious freedom as well as the dignity of the couples as well.
I've got the pleasure of having Carrie Severino with me, the chief counsel and policy director for the Judicial Crisis Network. So as you count the justices, with Neil Gorsuch being the one new factor that's different from last year, do you see a 5-4 decision on something like this in favor of the cake shop owner?
It's hard to say. It could easily be 5-4. It could also be one of those cases where, like last year's case that had about the religious use of the playground, the Trinity Lutheran case, that was a 7-2 case. And you saw Justices Kagan and Breyer, who are two of the liberal justices in the court, who said that, you know what, nonetheless, this church has a right not to be treated differently than other organizations in that case that were eligible for a state grant for playground improvements.
Mm-hmm.
So you could see a similar thing where they say, look, we might be personally supportive of same-sex marriage, but we see that there is a religious freedom interest here that says this man has a right to have his own religious exercise, too, and not be forced out of the marketplace. Currently, Jack Phillips has had to drop 40% of his business because he's simply not able to take any wedding cake orders, or the Colorado Civil Rights Commission will shut him down. So that's a situation that I think is untenable and is in conflict with our right to a religious exercise.
All right, so
protected by our Constitution.
Carrie, if this is decided in Jack Phillips' case, obviously it affects his business. Does it, by extension, since, you know, Supreme Court cases are precedent-setting cases, unlike the lower appeals courts, are not precedent-setting, at least outside of their individual districts. So if this is passed this way, does this mean that various state organizations like the Colorado Civil Rights Commission or the equivalent in all the other 50 states will have to change their policies if the Supreme Court decides in favor of Masterpiece Cake Shop?
It depends a little how they write the case. One thing they could say is simply, if you're going to allow exemptions for other people who have conscientious objections, as I said, for making a white supremacist cake or making a pro-traditional marriage cake, you have to allow it for everyone equally. They could easily make a decision like that, and that will depend on the state. Some states, I would hope, already have even-handed laws. They don't have to change it.
Do you know of one that does, Carrie?
I think there are a lot of places where people still are allowed to do business, according to their consciences, and I think that's how most of our country has operated. You know, if they were going around and refusing to do business with large swaths of people, they would probably be at this point not be successful businesses. So I think that has worked pretty well, but I think that it'll depend a little bit about how the court decides the case.
Why does it seem as though every time there's a ruling from the Supreme Court that I would characterize as a pro-liberal ruling, that it forces changes throughout society, but somehow when the conservative rulings come down, local governments, and maybe I'd use the Heller case as a good example of that, where Second Amendment rights were upheld, and that was more than a decade ago, and you've still got places in America that haven't sort of got with the program, that it seems to only cut one direction, at least from my point of view. You're the legal expert. Am I reading this wrong?
Well, it certainly should cut evenly, but I think you're right. There are either courts that want to try to read the cases as narrowly as possible. And unfortunately, with the Second Amendment issue, you're right. There's a lot of cities and states that have tried to push those limits, even knowing the Supreme Court wants to protect the Second Amendment. And since they haven't taken another case, that's just kind of been allowed to happen. So unfortunately, you need the courts to continue to police those boundaries, or you do end up with a one-way ratchet of states that, you know, if it's only the liberal states that are trying to push the limits on some of these constitutional protections, then we have to rely on the Supreme Court to push back for the Constitution. That's why I'm so excited to see someone like Justice Gorsuch on there, who recognizes the importance of those constitutional limits. But, it takes five. It takes five out of nine to be willing to really stand up and put those protections back in our real daily life.
So, Carrie, last question. From a procedural standpoint, is this one of those decisions that they'll hear now, but they won't announce until, 2 days before or the day before they walk out the door next June? Or is this one of those where we might hear the decision a lot sooner than that?
Oh, I think this is one of those wait till the end of June cases, both because we're already halfway through the year and it takes a while to write them. But boy, this is probably likely going to be one that has either some dissents or some real back and forth between the justices before it'll see the light of day. So stay tuned for June for finding out what really happened.
Very good. Carrie Severino, thank you very much. I appreciate the time, ma'am.
Have a great day.
You bet. Carrie Severino from the Judicial Crisis Network. Back in a moment with your phone calls and emails. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you on what I call a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Haven't had any great conspiracy theories yet, though. Although, I really want to get a hold of at least one member of Congress, and here's what I'd like to press them on an idea. This idea is so simple, and yet I think it could have such a great effect on getting rid of these sexual harassers, at least among elected officials. I don't think we're going to get rid of them among the staff. I think that's very difficult. Although individual members of the Senate and the House could tell their staff, the day that you're accused of sexual harassment, if there is convincing argument, convincing evidence that you've done it, you're out the door, just like Matt Lauer. But again, what would convincing evidence be? But here's my idea. Every member of Congress has to personally pay any sexual harassment claim where they have decided to agree to a settlement. That is, a member of your staff says, the congressman did X, Y, or Z to me, or the congresswoman, and I'm filing a complaint. Well, you could say, fine, we don't think your complaint is valid. We'll take it to a court. And then you can decide whether or not you want to settle it that way. If it's settled through a settlement, like the John Conyers case, where apparently he demanded sexual favors from a young lady and had to pay her off, but he paid her off with taxpayer money. Number one, the payoff has to be done out of the congressman's own pocket. Number two, the payoff must be published. And I want to make it within, let's say, within 30 days of the day that it's paid. And when it's published publicly, then the voters can make an independent judgment about whether or not they want to keep you as a member of Congress or not. to your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Josh is on the line from Joint Base Lewis-McChord. How you doing, Josh? Are you in the military?
Yes, I am. I had called you last year about the congressional, you know, with based upon the districts, but that was last year.
Thanks for your service, by the way. But go ahead.
Thank you. So with what's going on with Matt Lauer, what do you think the possibilities to bridge that talent gap of having Whoopi Goldberg in there? I'm not a fan of her politics.
Neither am I.
Whoopi, she's a household name in America. People know her. Us Trekkies always know her as Guinan. But what do you, until they find someone long-term, what do you think about Whoopi? Is Whoopi. She's a feel-good person. What do you think about that?
I frankly don't care if NBC goes down the toilet with their ratings, because I think that they have shown themselves to be a liberally biased news organization. So frankly, I don't care if they succeed or fail. But whether they succeed or fail is up to them and their own management. If they decide to bring on Whoopi Goldberg, would I bet on that? Probably not. I think the trend in television news right now is toward younger, especially with female hosts. And I think you're likely to see somebody replace Matt Lauer on that show, who is another woman. In fact, there's some talk in the trade publications for broadcasting that suggests that you'll probably see all women morning shows from now for quite some time. And you won't see any guys on there. I mean, Al Roker may be an example of, you know, a guy who's trustworthy or whatever that people aren't going to distrust. But the female demographic that watches those shows is so very important to the advertisers. I think they're going to get most of the males off those shows anyway, for obvious reasons. And I appreciate the phone call, and thanks for your service, Josh. Let's go to David in Puyallup. Hey, David, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to comment on that free tuition in Seattle.
Oh, from the mayor, the new mayor of Seattle, who's decided that it's time to give away more things?
Yeah, Gherkin. I'm not surprised by too much that comes out of Seattle these days, but being kind of close, I went to school in New Jersey, and they had a trade high school where you spent your first 2 years in a trade, studying every day and taking your regular classes. In your last 2 years, you were in regular classes in the morning, and then you went out to, if you were in welding or plumbing, you would go work with a company and get paid during your last 2 years. So when you graduated, you had your journeyman's card.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Yeah, that's a Burlington County Institute of Technology. And they could do something like that out here, and that would give people time to see what they like to do, get the classroom skills, and then they're out, they have a job, they're a journeyman, they got their card, they could go to the union, they could work for a construction company. You know, and they had IT, computers classes, they had building trades, everything.
I like the idea, especially because you're helping kids get started toward a trade in high school rather than, you know, David, I think there's been a trend toward allowing young men and women in America to delay their maturity. First it got delayed to 18, now it's delayed into their early 20s. Now you got people saying, well, their brains really don't mature till they're 25 or 26. You know, for some kids, they're going to ignore that and say, hey, I'm anxious to go out and take on the world. Good for them. But for the rest, who can then say, gosh, I think I'll delay, you know, becoming an adult. I'll live at mom and dad's house. I'll stay on their insurance. I won't actually get serious about any kind of training or trade or profession or anything like that. I think that's actually holding people back, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. When I was 18 years old, you know, my parents were talking to me about, you know, saving some money, compounding interest when you're in your 30s and the payoff in your 60s. And, you know, you're losing that. They're not getting to the point where they can actually start saving towards their future and building something for retirement. They're just spending their time, spinning their wheels, and they're trying to figure it out as they're in their late 20s and early 30s. What do I want to do for a long period of my life? And granted, they may change professions 4 or 5 times in their life.
Well, that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. But have at least some goal to head somewhere. Because, David, if you could imagine, you know, young man or woman coming out of high school and maybe needing a year or year and a half of trade school. But the problem is, I think politically, here's where you're going to run into it. The politicians want to run around and say every kid should go to college. Well, that's baloney. And it is baloney. because when I talk to economists, they say the most the economy needs is about 25 to 30% four-year degrees. The other 70% of students coming out of high school need some training in some field, but they don't need a four-year degree. It's a waste of time and money and effort and tuition and everything else. Well, do you think that the schools are going to adopt that kind of point of view where they tell parents, you know, about two-thirds of these kids need to go for a little bit of training, but probably not a whole lot, and only about a quarter to at most a third need a four-year degree? I think the folks who run our schools right now would choke on that message, and the politicians would too.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're, you know, the biggest part they're trying to do is get people under their wing and kind of put an indoctrination on them as well.
Well, they've got this giant system. By the way, thanks for the call from Joel, David, and thanks for listening on Talk Radio 570. You have an entire system of universities, and they want to support it, and they have to keep shoving kids into it who oftentimes end up getting degrees that aren't worth much in the job market. But boy, did they support a lot of six-figure jobs in those colleges. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. But first, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Scott Arusi for his time in uniform and his service to the United States. We all owe him a vote of thanks. We would also like, I'd like to support him in his efforts to try to take good care of veterans here in the Pacific Northwest. Unfortunately, he's had a tough time getting that done. Dr. Arusi, it's good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time.
Mr. Larson, fun.
I appreciate you coming on the program. It sounded like we had a little bit of a loose connection there, but would you mind sketching out very quickly your time in uniform and your time as a medical surgeon in Afghanistan?
So I graduated from the Air Force Academy and went to medical school, and then spent the remainder of my career as a physician in the Air Force. 28 and a half years of credible service to the government and to the people. During that time period, I had the privilege of deploying four times as a combat surgeon. My last deployment was in 2012 as the deputy commander for Craig Joint Theater Hospital in Afghanistan, which is one of the level one trauma centers and the busiest trauma center at that time, I think, in the world. I've also served as the consultant to the Surgeon General of the Air Force for general surgery, and I was a master clinician in the Air Force in my last 3 years stationed at the Air Force's largest hospital in California.
And Dr. Arusi, you wanted to work here in the Pacific Northwest taking care of veterans in the VA system. What happened?
Well, I initially joined civilian practice and worked as a trauma medical director and helped set up a level two trauma center. But I was seeing a lot of substandard care to our veterans, and it was really heartbreaking. And so I left my practice and joined the VA. Shortly after getting there, chief of surgery started questioning some of my practices, and I advised him that, you know, everything that I was doing was within standard of care and exceeded standard of care to some degree, if not at all times exceeded standard of care for the patients. He didn't take too kindly to this, and eventually, with ignoring all due process with respect to peer review, he basically ran me through a peer review in secret, denied me any access to findings, denied me any access to standing before my peers and presenting the data that supported what I did, and then summarily had me fired. 2 weeks after I started full-time with the VA, and actually contested that I was never actually employed full-time with the VA, although I worked 40 hours a week for 4 weeks straight.
And you were effectively fired?
Yes, terminated. I mean, the Friday afternoon at 3:30 on the 4th of August, he walked in, handed me a piece of paper, says, "You're terminated," took my ID and access badge and said, "Clear out your stuff."
Now, at this point, do you believe that there's good reason to believe that veterans in both Roseburg and in Eugene are getting substandard care within the VA system because of the things you observed and because of the decisions being made by not only the guy who fired you, but the rest of the system? And I want you to speak also to what's happened to the staff that worked with you and the positions they took and whether or not they were punished for standing up for you.
Okay. I think absolutely the care that is being provided to the veterans is substandard. And I want to make sure that we delineate between the care that's delivered because of leadership decisions and the care that's delivered by the frontline employees and physicians that are board certified and care very much about what they do.
Absolutely.
But they provide excellent care and should not be viewed as part of the problem. The problem is the leadership and that they bully, intimidate, threaten physicians and nurses so that they cannot maintain an adequate number of employed providers, whether it's a nurse, mid-level, or physician, to provide the care. So the first issue is inadequate services to provide the care. A perfect example is the Department of Urology here at the Eugene Healthcare Clinic, which is hardly manned at all, maybe one day a week. And there is a huge wait list for getting elevated PSAs followed up upon and taken care of appropriately. I mean, delays more than 30 days, which is a violation of the A standard.
By the way, Dr. Russi, for those people who are listening, I'm not a medical professional either, but I'm a male, so I know what an elevated PSA usually indicates. It indicates you got problems with your prostate, and you might even have prostate cancer. And getting on that quickly can be the difference, literally, between life or death, or between life with severe disability or life without disability. Correct?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the nurses that were following this. Treva Moss and Amber Byers actually stood up for me when I was fired. And since we went public with this in the local newspaper, the Register Guard, they've had their clinical responsibilities stripped from them. And they're no longer allowed to make decisions to facilitate health care for their patients. And they've been advocating for their patients for the past 18 months and doing an excellent job in trying to get local care for these patients with elevated prostate-specific antigen levels and fighting for them constantly and still not getting the care that they deserve. In fact, Treva, on a interview with the local television network, KZI, said that people are going to die because of this.
And this is happening to them as a form of retaliation against them for standing up and objecting to you being fired.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the third nurse that stood up for me, Treva Reicher, she had a job offer for full time. And the minute she stood up with me, they pulled that job offer within an hour. She filed a complaint against the Human Resources Department. And since then, they have messed repeatedly with her per diem paycheck because she still works at the VA as a per diem nurse when they need extra help. I mean, last month, she actually got a paycheck for $0 because they messed with her paycheck so much that the federal government withheld all of her pay.
I'm talking to Dr. Scott Russi, who has worked at the VA Eugene Healthcare Center. What do you think, doctor, is driving all of this, these decisions to get rid of you, to retaliate against the staff who stood up for you, the decisions to make veterans wait a long time for things that are very, very time sensitive in terms of life and death? What's driving that decision-making?
Well, I think the leadership there is mismanaging the VA greatly. I mean, if you look at the quality of leadership there and you look at the physicians that sit on the executive council or the executive leadership board, four out of those eight physicians are not board certified. They may have completed a residency, but they didn't have the horsepower to complete certification. So in the civilian sector, they would have a very, very hard time getting a job. In fact, it's required by, I think, every hospital that I've applied to in the civilian sector to be board certified in order to work there. So what we're seeing is a double standard in healthcare in the U.S. for the civilian sector and our veterans. The VA is willing to accept a non-board certified physician as an employee in their institution. And they don't even have the horsepower to demonstrate that they can meet the standard of care in a test. How can they meet the standard of care when they provide care to a patient? There are very many good board-certified physicians that work for the VA, but they tend to get pushed out by these non-board-certified physicians who are threatened.
Dr. Russi, let me ask you a couple more questions. The man who fired you is who?
Dr. Dinesh Ranjan.
All right. Does he go overseas to lecture about medical subjects?
He does. In fact, when he trained as a transplant surgeon. He worked at the University of Kentucky, and he was a professor there. And then he left there for some reason, which I don't know why, but it's very odd for a transplant surgeon to leave the transplant field and come to be a general surgeon in the VA. It doesn't make much sense to me because the transplant field is a very select field, very small field, very focused field, and suddenly he comes to the VA as a general surgeon. So he is currently the chief of surgery at the VA in Roseburg. And in 2016, he was in Calcutta lecturing as a professor of transplant surgery at the University of Kentucky.
But is he a professor of transplant surgery at the University of Kentucky?
You know, I've called the transplant department and asked for him, and Nate says he doesn't work there.
And he does work, and you know he works, in Roseburg and Eugene, right?
Yes, he does. Well, I don't... Work, I mean, that's defined work. Yeah. I mean, he's seen 127 patients in the last 2 years.
127 patients in the last 2 years. I'll tell you, doctor, I think this is one more of these examples that we've been hearing about where the VA system is very, very messed up and needs some real course correction. And I applaud you and your efforts to try to get this fixed. I know that investigators have been looking into Roseburg and Eugene, and they've been interviewing staff. Do you have any level of confidence that those investigations will actually find out what's wrong in these VA medical centers and fix it?
I don't. I mean, this is kind of like letting your coyote watch your chickens. I mean, they came and investigated Dr. Ranjan for performing colonoscopies. He performed 78 colonoscopies between 2013 and 2014. The chief of surgery down there at that time, prior to him coming in, and the gastroenterologists were a little concerned about his performance of the procedures. They didn't think he was doing it appropriately. So they asked for a review of all physicians that were doing colonoscopies. So they had a review of all three physicians that were doing colonoscopies, and he was found not to meet standard care. They ended up complaining to Congressman DeFazio, and he ordered an investigation. The IG came in and investigated. Now, the IG found that he inappropriately performed the procedure, but no harm was done. The problem with that statement is that it was at 24 months after the procedures were done. At the least, it may have been 12 months. You have to wait at least 3 years to make that statement. So they couldn't even make an honest review of inappropriately performed procedures. Had he been in the civilian sector, he would have had his privileges pulled for those procedures, and he would never perform those again. He still is privileged in the VA system to perform colonoscopies. I do not think that the VA can review itself and give an honest answer. They have protected him because they're not willing to stand up and say, look, we made a mistake. This is what we have to do to correct it. In fact, the one physician down there that tried to correct it, Dr. Lisa Brandenberger, was retaliated against. She was summarily removed from health care and forced to sit in an office for, I think, 2 or 4 weeks before they allowed her to go back and see patients. And her life essentially has been ruined. Although she's still working for the VA, she cannot work anywhere else. She cannot get malpractice insurance to work anywhere else. And she has a huge investigation that's been going on for 3 years that still has not been concluded.
That doesn't sound right. Dr. Russi, I'll look forward to checking in with you as this goes on, and I really appreciate you taking the time to advise people about what's going on in this VA system, and thanks again for your service in uniform to our country.
Well, thank you, sir. You have a good day.
And you as well. Dr. Scott Russi, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Thursday, and don't forget, tomorrow we celebrate First Amendment Friday, as we do every single week, and we'll do it live from my favorite gun store, Northwest Armory, and if you wanted to, stop by. We'd be glad to talk to you in person. Let me go first to Rick in Medford, listening on KMED. Hey, Rick, thanks, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Yes, Lars, thank you very much. I'm new to Medford from Colorado, and so I'm new to your program, and I just want to say it's a great program.
Well, thank you.
Great job.
I appreciate it.
And it's just things like Dr. Rusi that you just had on that these things with VA. I was a pharmaceutical rep calling on VA hospitals, and they are a disaster across our great nation. But what I really called about was the mayor up in Seattle that wants to promote free community college.
Yeah.
And I just, from an economics standpoint, I'd like to point out that if you make it free, you're going to get more people taking those courses and involved in it, which means more graduates.
Not necessarily more graduates, though. Do you understand that?
Well,
because
that's
no. I'm just pointing out there's a lot of data already about when people get Pell Grants and such to go in and take community college, an amazing number of people drop out and without finishing community college, even with all the assistance that's given. It's sometimes as high as 50% dropout and simply don't finish.
Well, that's a great point.
Yeah,
That's a great point, and I probably should just say there'd be more people participating in the programs, and therefore the more cost of infrastructure and teachers to pay for it. And the upshot of all of this is you're going to increase the costs and decrease the quality of the product and send out more people out into the marketplace to find jobs, which means the employers are going to be able to pay less. So the folly of the whole thing is you're going to increase costs to get a poorer product and serve the people in a poorer fashion.
But isn't that exactly what government specializes in? Increasing costs, delivering a poor product, and generally screwing things up. I think government gets an A in that every day of the week.
You're absolutely correct. And the VA hospital is a good example of that. And it's just a sad state that we're in.
I'll tell you what, I was so glad to have Dr. Rusi be willing to come on. And I talked to him for quite a while off the air before the program because I wanted to hear a lot of the background on what was being done to him, what was being done to patients. You realize the kind of courage it takes to do that because you go out and talk to the newspaper, talk to the talk show and all that. It doesn't necessarily do you any good because it can often inflame the very people fighting against you. You got the Lars Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Thursday. We've got First Amendment Friday coming up tomorrow live from Northwest Armory. Stop by if you get the chance. You know, I saw this story out of Yakima, and I want to tell you something. When I tell you that the rules of engagement for police are just about as crazy as they can ever get. And that's one of the reasons that big cities like Portland and Eugene and Seattle and Spokane and even the Tri-Cities are having troubles is because the rules of engagement for their police are crazy. So get this. I get here at 0:30 this morning, and there's a story about the Yakima police, the city of Yakima. They are now investigating their own officer to find out if he did something wrong. Here's what happened. The Yakima Herald says that this is the second time in 2 months that authorities have had to investigate a suspect being hit by a police vehicle. And I thought, well, I have to read about this and find out what crazy thing did that police officer do that caused him to be investigated. Well, Yakima police spokesman Mike Bastinelli says that officers yesterday responded to a report of a man weaving in and out of traffic with a knife held to his own throat. It's kind of like, I guess I have immediately envisioned that scene out of Blazing Saddles with words you can't use on the radio today. But in that case, that was a gun. This is a knife. So there's a guy weaving in and out of traffic with a knife held to his own throat. I've never heard of that before, but okay, he's crazy. What would you do? Police shut down surrounding intersections while they tried to get the guy to surrender. I mean, they were working to save the guy's life. Police say the incident ended when an officer hit the car with his police car. Now, the man was taken to the hospital. He had non-life-threatening injuries. So, you had the end of a public hazard to safety. You had the end of the incident with the man kept alive, who, driving crazy through traffic with a knife held to your own throat, is not generally the way to stay alive. And all they had to do was hit his car with a police car. Now, I'm sure there's going to be some body work to do on the police car, but do you really have to have an investigation when things end that well to find out whether or not the police officer should have done it? Maybe he should have let the guy drive crazy for a while until he hurt somebody. I mean, this is the kind of craziness we got to put up with today. At this point in the program today, I had expected to be talking to Washington State's Lieutenant Governor Habib, Cyrus Habib. But we had the interview all set up, and here's why I wanted to talk to him. And we told Lieutenant Governor Habib's people why we wanted to talk to him, because he has signed an executive order on Monday that bans all firearms, even those carried legally by people with concealed carry permits, from the public galleries above the Senate floor of the Washington State Senate in Olympia. Now, Cyrus Habib had campaigned that he wanted to do this. He says he's trying to create a safer environment by making the galleries above the State Senate in Olympia into gun-free zones, even though, as I pointed out on Monday, gun-free zones are where most of the fatalities happen in mass shootings in America. Gun-free zones are dangerous places. And I wanted to ask Lieutenant Governor Habib about that. So we set up an interview, and we told his people, one young lady in particular, his assistant, why Christina Brown, why we wanted to talk to him. And she agreed to the interview. And he agreed to the interview, and she asked, what is the interview about? What are you going to ask him about? And we told her exactly what it was about. We never blindside anybody on an interview. If I try to get an interview with somebody, we do not say we want to talk about the Seahawks, or we want to talk about the Blazers, or we want to talk about the weather. We tell them exactly what we want to talk to them about, because then they can make the decision whether or not they want to do it or not. So just after midnight last night, I get the following email from Christina Brown. The lieutenant governor will not be doing the interview tomorrow. We were interested in having a productive, genuine, and respectful conversation based on your article this week. I don't even know what that is. An article? I do radio. Okay. I'm disappointed to see that you do not seem to share that interest, so I will not be making time in the lieutenant governor's schedule for the interview tomorrow. So I wrote back to her because she's a state employee and I pay some of her salary with my taxes. And I said, Ms. Brown, I am disappointed in Lieutenant Governor Habib's decision to go south on a scheduled interview, but not that surprised. I had hoped that the lieutenant governor was made of sterner stuff. It turns out he's just an ordinary Democrat with no intestinal fortitude. We made it clear what the subject matter was, and I figured that Lieutenant Governor Habib would know that a conservative talk host would not be throwing him softballs. I'll be happy to let his constituents know that Habib does not have the courage of his convictions to stand up and take a few tough questions about his anti-Second Amendment position. Let me know if he gains the courage someday to take some real questions. And at that point, we're not getting the interview with Lieutenant Governor Habib. My question to him would be, how does it make the Senate gallery safer to ban law-abiding citizens who are carrying pistols, since, as I just pointed out, the Crime Prevention Research Bureau says that 98% of the mass shootings that have occurred in American history in the last 20, 30 years have happened in gun-free zones, and you are now making part of the state legislature into a gun-free zone. Doesn't make sense to me. Anyway, to your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And by the way, the door always remains open for Lieutenant Governor Habib should he grow the intestinal fortitude and be willing to come on and talk about it. Let's go to Don in Bellingham. Hey, Don, thanks for listening on KGMI. What's on your mind?
Oh, thanks for taking the call. I just had a quick comment, and I'd like to know your opinion.
All right.
Congress, I've seen a short news clip, just passed themselves a bill to require their members to take sexual harassment training.
Yep.
At our expense, the taxpayers' money, for all these psychiatrists and counselors, every man I've ever known is instinctively knows what sexual harassment is. Now, do we have to pay these people's salary for these dummies to go to school to learn that?
I guess we do. Let me give you, although I'm generally not in favor of the training, and I'll tell you why, because most of the studies say that when they have done training in companies, it does not reduce the incidence of sexual harassment. In some cases, it can actually make it worse. and it can actually adversely affect the opportunities open to young men and young women. However, there is one benefit that I can say. While you say it's absolutely obvious to everyone what sexual harassment is, I think, Don, you'll find out that depending on somebody's age and their background, it may not be obvious to them. It may be that there are, I'll be one to bet that Matt Lauer had been through sexual harassment training at NBC. It didn't seem to do him any good at all. And obviously, Billy Clinton did not have the first clue about what the proper way was to treat a woman. And apparently neither did John Conyers. So there are some people out there who don't know. And with that in mind, the benefit of having the training done is this. If later on somebody says, well, I didn't know that making comments about a woman's, clothing or appearance or decolletage or anything else was sexual harassment, you could say, well, you went through the training and we have your signature right here that you understood that and that was explained in the training. So it would have that benefit that nobody could ever say, I didn't know that what I was doing was sexual harassment. Back in just a moment, you're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's always a pleasure to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me go first to Paul in Federal Way. Hey, Paul, thanks a lot for listening on KVI. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Lars. I'm calling regarding your discussion about vocational education, the lack thereof, the overemphasis on college education, et cetera.
Yeah.
My first career, I was a school counselor, and that was back until 1986. Anyway, in the last few years of doing that at a high school, we had vocational training in the high school, which was like auto mechanics, carpentry, drafting, graphic arts, et cetera.
Yeah.
And we presented an idea to the school board, which they accepted and we implemented, which was to have different types of high school diplomas, including a general, which was better than the state requirements, an academic, which was preparatory for four-year college, and a vocational, which emphasized the various programs that we had. And we coordinated with the various vocational technical institutes and the community colleges that had vocational programs to see how much credit they would give students who had taken these programs and gotten the vocational diploma if they had gone on to those vocational schools.
Yeah.
And it was a very good program and plan. And yet it seems in the years since, hence, vocational training in high schools has deteriorated and become somewhat non-existent.
Why do you
and
think
yet,
that
this
is?
Was a way that, well, I think, one, of course, in the last 8 years, we had this overemphasis on college.
Yep.
For everyone. And we've had, so much, I guess, ease in terms of getting financial aid, which then becomes impossible to pay back for many people. And I think the focus has been taken off a lot of the vocational programs. And kids just don't hear about it.
I want to ask you why, and I hate to say this, but I'm going to blame it on your profession to some extent and to the politicians to another extent. That is, should I expect that a building full of professionals, and teachers are professionals, many of whom, well, all of whom have bachelor's degrees, some have master's degrees, and I would imagine the principals and some of the other upper administration, some of them might even have PhDs. Am I describing them appropriately?
I would agree, and I would also say that, yes, that was my first profession. I have
no, I get that, but let's stick with it. Let's stick with the point you were making. See, I think this is so critical to make sure we understand why it's happening. Okay, because if you don't know why it's happening, you don't know how to stop it from happening. So why have the schools steered kids away from vocational ed and toward a college prep? Because the entire building is full of people who have multiple college degrees. So do you think they have much regard for those blue-collar trades?
They did when I was involved in this vocational degree program implementing, and that was back in the mid-80s, and it has changed since, and I haven't been involved, so I haven't personally seen why, but
it seemed like a great idea because the vocational schools, which are very vocationally oriented, were in cahoots with the high schools, our high school, to implement and allow for credit in those institutions from the programs in the high school.
Yep.
And now, I don't know why it went away.
Well, I mean, my theory is that both politicians and professional educators have said, we don't think much of a non-college future for kids. We think that all kids can go to college. The problem is the economy doesn't need it. And I had a young lady email me a moment ago and say, where was that study? I said, it's not a study. It's just that every time I've had a top flight economist on the program, I've said, how many four-year degree trained employees does our economy need? And we have a very modern economy. We have a technological society. And the economists routinely tell me, you might need 25 to 30% college degrees. The rest of the young men and women are going to need some other kind of training, but not a four-year degree. It doesn't do them any good. And yet you have politicians setting goals of saying, we want 40 or 50 or 60% of young men and women to go out and get a college degree. All that's going to do is degrade the value of a college degree. Let's go to Hernan. Hernan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hey, I enjoyed your discussion about the guns. So did you see the story about the Taco Bell in Cleveland where two guys came to rob them and all the employees were packing and they shot the assailants?
I've seen a number of stories like that. I don't know that I've seen that one, but I get the point.
Anyway, so back to I'm a sort of a provocative naysayer.
You have to get to the point, though.
Is our Capitol building in Washington a gun-free zone or not?
No, that's yes and no. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but Hernan, what's happened is this guy, Cyrus Habib, the lieutenant governor, has signed an executive order making the Capitol gallery above the Senate into a gun-free zone. The hallways and the committee rooms are not gun-free zones. So he's keeping guns out of part of the building and not out of the rest of the building. So how would I answer your question? Yes or no, or both?
Yeah. Man. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Well, and in fact, do you think how much? Well, you weren't exactly a provocative naysayer in that case. But let's go to Jay. Hey, Jay, welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, Lars, how are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I got to tell you that one of the things that frustrates me more than anything is this topic of entitlement and what we're giving to these kids. And I have a unique perspective because I deal with it on a daily basis as a collegiate coach, actually. And we're actually doing such a disservice to these kids if we create plans like this to give them something for nothing. And what's so frustrating to me is it's a wolf in sheep's clothing that nobody seems to recognize or call out. And it's so short-sighted with the thinking because we're not teaching these kids anything. We're just giving them stuff. And, it goes against everything we do as a coach, working with entitlement. There's three-pronged approach that you typically take to dealing with entitlement, and it's creating a culture of selflessness, teaching accountability to the kids, and molding your desired behaviors that you want. And with politicians like this up in Seattle, they're ignoring the first two, and they're definitely molding the desired behavior they want, which is to create more people with a lack of confidence, thinking they need help from other people, that they can't do things on their own, and they need to get things for free. And it's just such a disservice to these young kids because, they're not learning how to the value of hard work. I had every opportunity given to me when I was 18 years old. I had parents who could afford to send me to school. And I was kind of a lazy teenager. I chose to focus on other things besides school, like money. I liked having money for nice things and to date. And it caught up to me. My parents basically said, hey, you didn't make your grades. We're not going to pay for your school.
That makes sense. And you actually had good parents in that case. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Thursday afternoon. Don't forget tomorrow, First Amendment Friday. And one little advisory. I know that those of us on the West Coast are always thinking about the possibility of earthquakes, but we don't hear about them on the East Coast very often at all. A magnitude 5.1 earthquake has rattled the East Coast from Baltimore all the way to New York. We'll get you details. Now, that one's probably not serious enough in size to have caused any real damage, but it is a concern that something like that would happen. But usually, earthquakes, that's a West Coast, a left coast kind of thing. David Cross joins us now, as he does every week, with a little update on some of the illegal alien activities around the Pacific Northwest. David, welcome back, and what's on your mind?
It's good to be with you, Lars. Lars, we have a criminal alien report out of the state of Washington. An illegal alien in Washington allegedly was involved in social media, to be specific, Facebook, in Washington's Franklin and Benton counties, where he would sexually prey on children by using Facebook. Valentin Alejandro Cox-Rajon is incarcerated in the Franklin County Jail. That's and he has been charged with first-degree possession of displacing the minor, engaged in sexual explicit conduct of a minor, photographs of a minor, you know, engaged in sexual conduct, second-degree child rape, 2 counts of sexually exploitation of a minor, 3 counts of third-degree child rape, first-degree possession of child pornography. He's on $1 million of bail. Turns out in Benton County, neighboring Benton County, he's facing third-degree child rape charges. So he is engaged in sexual activity, allegedly, with children in 2 counties. It turns out that at the Franklin County Jail, they placed an immigration detainer on him. Well, I contacted Immigration Customs Enforcement, and they indicated that the woman from ICE indicated that this guy did have an immigration hold on him, and that ICE had placed it there, and that he was a Mexican national. So we have an illegal Mexican national preying on 12 and 14-year-old girls, allegedly.
Absolutely crazy stuff. And I'll tell you, almost every week, David, I see another example of somebody who's committing crimes like this, oftentimes sexual crimes, oftentimes against children, and people who are not in this country legally. And yet you see the left defending the DACA crowd, the left demanding all kinds of equal rights for people who are not in this country legally. David, thanks a lot. I very much appreciate the update. Let's go to Sarah, who's calling in from Kennewick. Sarah, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, your fan club president again. Listen, Sarah, I have several friends from on this thing about the, you know, getting the college degree versus the voc tech. I have several friends from Kosovo here, and they have said in Kosovo they had to go the last 4 years, I believe, they said, of high school and learn a trade. They had to be taught a trade.
Yeah.
Then when they get out, they have to set up a business. They have to take someone in and train them. So they're, you know, a twofold thing there. They're training people, and then they've got the training already. They're not just being pitched out of high school with, you know, and those trades, you know, have you had your car worked on lately? You know what mechanics make?
They make good money.
Yes, they do. I know. I just did it. You know, this is there. Yeah, there's something to this situation with training kids or.
Yeah, but do you think it makes sense for somebody like the new mayor of Seattle, Jenny Durkin, to sign an executive order ordering that the city start paying literally millions of dollars to provide free of charge community college for anybody who wants it, who's graduated from high school, whether they have the GPA to justify it, whether they're legally in the country or not, they get free of charge community college paid for by the taxpayers?
Well, Lars, there's not too much that's sensible in Seattle area anyway or anymore anywhere, anything. Even this thing with the veterans and the VA hospital, and I worked in medical work, too, and, you know, clerical-type situation. And I can't believe the way we're treating our veterans. And didn't the president just have some situation where he was either doing something with the VA that he's on the...
Well, he's trying to fix the problem by getting a new law. Well, the new law is in place now that it makes it easier to fire bad employees from the federal government. No, that's the way to make it happen. I appreciate the phone call, by the way. Speaking of the VA, Timothy is on the line from Eugene, listening on KPNW. Did you hear that interview we did with Dr. Scott Roosey?
I did, Mr. Lars. It's awesome, man. About time somebody's, trying to break it down. And I've been through 7 doctors in 14 months since I've got down here from Alaska, and it's horrible. Those people over there, there's a lot of good employees on the lower echelon. I can say that for sure.
I don't doubt it.
But on the upper echelon, the management is horrible. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, so the management at the VA needs to go, and I'm not sure how they're going to do about it, especially if the doctor was saying they've had an IG inspection for 3 years going on. What's the holdup?
Well, I think when they finally finish that IG investigation, they ought to take all the recommendations and actually implement them. Let's go to Rick and Ben. Hey, Rick, thanks for listening on KBND. What's on your mind today?
Thank you, Lars. Thank you for doing what you do.
Thanks.
Great American. Say, we just had a bizarre situation here in Central Oregon early this afternoon.
What is it?
Our power went out between Bend and Redmond, knocking out 5,400 homes. And I just found out just a little while ago and had to call you, it was caused by a goose.
What was the goose
and
doing?
Like, are you kidding? There was some major power lines going to a substation up by Eagle Crest. And that goose apparently created a short between two of those big power lines.
So,
I've never heard such a thing.
So, well, sure you have. Haven't you ever heard about somebody getting his goose cooked?
Well,
I guarantee you that goose is cooked right now.
Oh, man. But
he's well done.
Without that much power, a goose. Now, to get back on subject, we need vocational training because things happen like gooses.
Or geese. I mean, they happen, and you got to get people out there who can handle the power lines. Otherwise, Otherwise, you end up like Puerto Rico. And I appreciate the phone call. We're going to break a little bit earlier. When we come back, I'm going to talk to the Oregon Secretary of State, Dennis Richardson, about a brand new audit that shows $88 million in overpayments in Medicaid. This is the kind of massive mismanagement of federal money that doesn't justify giving another single dime to state government. And yet they're asking for a massive tax on hospitals because they say we need the money. Well, you got to stop mismanaging the money you already have. We'll talk to Dennis Richardson about that next, and your phone calls and emails at 866-439-5277. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And how's this for a conspiracy theory? If you have Democrats running a state in the legislature and in the governor's office, and they accidentally misspend $88 million on Medicaid, and then the Oregon Secretary of State, the lone Republican in state government in Oregon, finds this out and ferrets out all the information. Oregon Secretary of State Dennis Richardson joins me now. Mr. Secretary, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Well, Lars, it's good to be with you.
What should Oregonians think when they hear $88 million in overpayments over 4 years? And was this deliberate or accidental?
Well, the $88 million was actually just between March and September of this year.
Mm-hmm.
There have been over 100,000 individuals whose eligibility had not been determined, some of them for as long as 4 years. And so we've been making payments on people that may have moved away or for whatever reason was no longer eligible under the program, and that money could have been spent, the state's portion of it could have been spent on education or for seniors or for foster care or so many other things. What people need to take away is that we're watching. The audits division is no longer just auditing for the benefit of agencies, but for the people and for their elected representatives, the legislators, and we're going to continue to make it fair and transparent and accountable, which is what I was elected to do.
Mr. Secretary of State, should some of that money be clawed back from the people it was paid to if it was paid illegally and improperly?
Well, I know that the OHA is going to take a look at that. And Where they're really going to look closely is how much of it went to the coordinated care organizations, because they have ongoing relationships with them, and if they got paid for people that have moved away or were unavailable for treatment, that'll be looked at. But we need to understand that people have coverage until their eligibility is determined to no longer apply. And so they had coverage as far as the federal government is concerned until they were determined to be ineligible, or else that $88 million figure would be much larger.
All right, so how big is the actual amount of misspending? Is there any way to determine that from this look at this relatively shorter period of time?
No, other than it's hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, ever since the fall of Cover Oregon, the whole debacle that was back in 2013 and 2014, we've had problems determining eligibility. The federal government told OHA that they don't have to comply with this requirement that everyone's eligibility is determined annually. They didn't have to comply with that requirement, for a period of time. Well, that period of time, there was a couple of extensions. It really ended last June. And so then I'm told, or the auditors were told, actually, I didn't do the audit. The auditors were told that there was a verbal extension through January or February of this year. And so that's why we looked at, well, what is it from March through September when we finally got the numbers and it finally got cleared up? And that's where we got the $88 million.
Well, should we run a system on the basis that you get a benefit until they figure out that you're not eligible for it? Or should we run it the way most of the rest of government runs, which is, if I walk into a state office, Ms. Secretary, and say, I think I'm entitled to unemployment payments, or I think I'm entitled to a building permit or some other kind of permit, they will demand that I prove that I'm eligible before I get it. In this case, you're telling us millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars were paid out on people who were never determined to be eligible. And in fact, at the end of the day, were determined to be ineligible for it. That seems to be the opposite of the way that most government runs.
Well, Lars, I'm here on your show today as Secretary of State,
yeah.
And so I've got personal opinions on things, but I don't think it's appropriate for me to give that one, only to report on what our audits division came up with, that we have disclosed this major problem. There were like 8 or 10 different recommendations. The new director, which is Pat Allen, is a good guy. Immediately when he took over, there was an opening up of the books that we had not enjoyed during the previous months of the audit. It was a game that was being played to try and prevent us from getting information that we needed. The new leadership is saying, look, I'm going to let it all come out because that's part of my job, or our job is in the Secretary of State's office for audits. And he's also letting the governor know where things have been at, the problems that he's seeing, and they're doing a thorough investigation. So I'm expecting that there's going to be a change in the way business has been done at OHA.
Was any of the money paid illegally? And I'll give you a specific example. We understand that monies were paid from federal monies that were paid to aid abortion. Well, that's illegal. Under the Hyde Amendment, we're not supposed to spend any federal tax dollars on abortions. Do you know whether or not that happened?
Well, there are other, by that definition of illegality, yes. I mean, we paid, when you have people that are called dual eligibles, that means that these poor souls are eligible both for Medicaid and Medicare. The payments are supposed to be made under a Medicare level, a rate, which is lower than the Medicaid rate. But in reality, there was some $74 million, and it could be more, that was paid at the wrong rate, and $10 million of that has already been reimbursed to the federal government, and there may be more that has to be in the future.
All right. Can we say today that all of the overpayment has stopped, or the misspending has stopped?
No, I really can't say that. The audit shows how things were at a point in time, and we know that Pat Allen and his new crew are going through and investigating everything, and they're disclosing what they're finding, but those investigations are going to take months to complete.
So if you know based on that snapshot in time that you were seeing overpayments, is it likely that overpayments are still going on unless something has meaningfully changed?
I think it's unlikely. I think that once the leadership and the members in OHA realize what's happening, they stop continuing to do it, but it's a big project and a big program. You know, there's billions of dollars at stake. Just Medicaid alone is $9.3 billion a year. And so it's just a huge amount of money with many, many programs. And so it's going to take time for them to dig through it. But I'm confident that as they find out what is happening, where there needs to be corrections, those corrections will be made. But as a Secretary of State, my job is merely to expose good and bad, what we find in the audits, in a very neutral and professional way. And then it's up to the legislators to do the oversight and the governor to do the oversight of what's going on in these offices.
Very good. Mr. Secretary of State, it's a pleasure to have you on the program always. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Okay. It's always good to talk to you.
Glad to have you on. That's Secretary of State Dennis Richardson. $88 million in avoidable expenditures because the Oregon Health Authority failed to address Medicaid renewals in a timely manner. They took your money and they flushed it out tens of millions of dollars at a time. And it doesn't sound like they're going to get any of it back because, after all, it's your money. Why would they care about your money? And Dennis Richardson is right. He has opinions. I have opinions. I think they treat your money in a very disrespectful way. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.